So, welcome to the final session of Marxism 2019. It is a tragedy. But hopefully you've learned a lot about the world and how to change it and are ready to put that all into action when this day finishes. My name's Omar. I'll be facilitating today. DT is going to be speaking, also known as Daniel. He's a socialist at Monash University and has done some pretty cool stuff out there, which I'm sure he can tell you about after this session. We might get started. This is the kind of topic that's actually quite important and has a lot of questions will arise, I reckon. So write it down as you go, so that when the time for discussion comes, you know, there's plenty of things to get the conversation going. So kick it off, DT.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to the discussion. The question, I mean, of the relationship between socialists and parliament is of interest for a number of reasons, not least of which because the socialist alternative for the second time ever is now participating in a serious election campaign, the upcoming federal election campaign, as part of a broader formation. We did one at the end of last year. That was the first one that we've ever done, the Victorian state election. We gave it a go. It's also obviously of interest because there are quite a lot of people now in English-speaking countries, which has been rare for the last little period, in parliaments who describe themselves as socialists. So, you know, people, the figures like Jeremy Corbyn in the British Labour Party, certain figures in the United States Congress as well. And people will hopefully know by now, having been to previous sessions at the conference and potentially some of our other events, the socialist alternative, our worldview and our general Marxist approach is bitterly, bitterly hostile to the idea that socialism or indeed any meaningful reform can be achieved through parliamentary processes and procedures. Bitterly hostile to that, and yet parliament's emerging as a central question for socialists, self-described socialists around the world. And parliamentary elections are something that we're engaging in now. So I want to go through basically summarising the broadly the Marxist approach to these questions and some of the debates that have come up. It's a very pointed example that I think exemplifies both the dangers and the potential opportunities that come out of participation in parliament for socialists from 100 years ago. It's an example I want to return to a few times. The example of the German socialist, the big socialist party in Germany that still exists, the German Social Democratic Party, at the time of the outbreak of World War I, quite famously, this is a party that Karl Marx had been involved in founding and that had taken a turn towards prioritising parliament and indeed attempting to form government. The socialist party that famously, many here will know the story, when World War I broke out, abandoned all of its long-standing historical principles and supported the nationalists. War drive, the repression of workers' rights, and so on. Most people know that story in the socialist movement as the key example of how the development of a parliamentary approach to socialism leads to betraying every principle that socialists should stand for, far short of achieving socialism, even just in terms of standing against war, supporting workers' rights to strike, supporting free speech for the working class, and so on. The Social Democrats famously betrayed all of that. That wasn't the only thing that happened in the German socialist movement in parliament, though, at that time either. Though there was a figure who had emerged out of the Social Democrats, was a member of the Social Democrats, a figure called Karl Liebknecht, who was a member of parliament at that time, who, when he, in the parliament, at first as an individual, took a stand against the war, voted against the war, and spoke against the war, and was persecuted badly for it, he became, as an individual, a sort of a rallying point for what would become the emerging revolutionary workers' movement in Germany, which would not long afterwards overthrow the government in one of the most significant revolutions ever to happen in history. And his stand in parliament actually massively accelerated that revolutionary process. So it wasn't just the fact that the thing that socialists did in parliament overwhelmingly at that time was betray, but that wasn't the only thing that socialists did. There was a socialist who used the position in parliament to achieve something quite different. And looking at those two different sides of what socialists can do in parliament, I think can give us a good understanding of what we want to do to the extent that we do participate in elections. What is it? What is a parliament? I use the term quite broadly, you know, some sort of legislative body that's elected, basically. You know, the United States Congress is a parliament for my purposes, whatever. From the standpoint of what you'll learn in a civics course or whatever, or if you ever were elected into parliament and were taught by the civil servants about what your duties are and what the nature of a parliament is, you'd be told it's a freely elected democratic institution that allows the whole of society to participate in decision-making through the process of electing democratically elected representatives who make laws that apply to everyone absolutely equally. And because everyone has the equal right to vote and because the laws apply to everyone equally, existence of a parliament means that no matter what inequalities exist in society, no matter what oppressions and injustices exist, there's a way to resolve them in a sphere of life where everyone's got the same exact rights. And so you can overcome whatever inequality. If you don't like, the richest person in the world, Gina Reinhart, is oppressing you, whatever, you've got the exact same right to vote as what she has. Your vote counts for just precisely the same amount. And so there's a sphere where you're exactly equal, and that sphere of parliament makes the laws that apply to everyone equally. So it has a certain, it means that no matter what, if you're in a parliamentary democracy, on some level it is fundamentally egalitarian and democratic. And that idea, as that parliaments can have that effect, is a very powerful idea. It's something that is easy to mock, but it's something that people really believe either is true or ought to be true. It's something that people have, that, you know, we can make fun of it now, but people have sacrificed greatly to achieve this kind of an institution, fought great revolutions to get parliaments constructed along these lines, given their lives in the battle to get a parliament that will have those properties. And I think now, even when people are very cynical about politicians and about political parties, many still believe that parliament could, should, or is currently like that. It's a powerful idea because of what it promises about the ability to create a sphere where we can change things peacefully. It's not like that. It doesn't have that effect. And we can see that empirically pretty easily when we look at what's happened when governments have been formed in parliament over time, where people have tried to express those hopes through them. And what we can see from that process is under capitalism, as hopefully people will have discussed in some of the previous sessions in Marxism, where real power in society is wielded class on class through the process of exploitation. Social power of the capitalists exists outside of parliament and outside of the government more broadly, which allows them to discipline the parliament and us using their economic power if that economic power isn't challenged. And that means that no matter who's in government, what politicians are elected, in what coalition and on what program, the ruling class maintain their power over the economy and can use that to disrupt, undermine, and discipline any government. Not developed, I mean, the modern thing that we think of as parliaments, even to describe parliaments as a democratic institution, is actually a pretty recent phenomenon. If you look in Britain, they call the British parliament the mother of parliaments because it's been a model for parliaments all over the world. But when it was 150 years ago, if you suggested the British parliament had anything to do with democracy, it would have been ridiculous. The parliamentary system was the opposite of democracy, and it was seen as such by its advocates. In the original parliamentary systems, which were basically councils of the nobility and the ruling class of different kinds to discuss their affairs as they ruled over the exploited population. And those initial institutions, the struggle for people to participate in the elections that determined who was in them, expanded over time the number of people and the nature of the people, the class position of the people that were able to vote in them. And a lot of those battles to participate in elections are some of the most important battles that the oppressed and the working class ever participated in. And as you develop a situation where parliaments had completely changed, well, they were, and were things that everyone could vote in, like now, which is a relatively recent development in politics, where you do have the expectation that more or less most people who are adults can vote. This creates a new challenge for the ruling classes to figure out, well, how do you then continue to rule stably over the population when they do all get to vote in the thing that determines who the government is? And there are a number of different methods that they experimented with over time, and a number of different systems developed to help make sure that no matter who has the right to vote, the system remains stable. The obvious one that, you know, I talk to people about this a lot, and there's a few things that everyone knows about that obviously come to mind. The funding of political parties, control of the media, the bribery of elected politicians. These are all very typical and all very common. And if, it, as is likely, the Labor Party wins the next election, Bill Shorten becomes the Prime Minister, it is, I would say, absolutely certain that when he finishes his term as Prime Minister, he'll end up, like every ex-Labor politician does now, on the board of directors of various corporations, perhaps in a different lobby group, like the bank lobby group that Anna Bligh is leading now, or the mineral and gas lobby group that Martin Ferguson, a minister in former Labor governments, is leading now. But this is it's so routine now that it's wrong to conceive of it even as bribery. It's just a career path for Labor politicians that's completely expected now. More significant, though, if you do have a politician that presents, or a government that presents any kind of disruptive challenge well short of socialism to the priorities of the ruling class, the much more significant than that in the powerful methods of discipline are, for example, wielding that economic power, such as threatening as was perpetrated against the Greek government recently, just a few years ago, to crash the economy if they don't collaborate with the immediate priorities of the capitalist class. Even that was even done, not sure if people remember this now, it seems like such a long time ago, to Kevin Rudd, a very right-wing Labour Party politician who sort of boasted openly about how conservative he was on economic and class questions as well as social questions. Even he, at a certain point, when he introduced or attempted to introduce a reform that was inconvenient, not even to the capitalist class generally, but just a little section of it, the mining industry, they made such overt threats to damage the economy and bring down the government that the Labour Party got rid of him themselves before he could do it. If, in the very rare circumstances, we don't see these processes happen very much in Australia because the politicians in this country are so right-wing, in the very rare circumstances where they exceed those boundaries, then the method of last resort is actually quite simple. It's the destruction of the elected parts of the state. And that's an important concept to have, I think, when considering the role of Parliament, because Parliament's the focus of politics for us. It's the only thing that we're allowed to vote in, really. So we think of it as defining what politics is. But Parliament's only a tiny part of the powerful institutions in society, the overwhelming majority of which are unelected. I mean the majority of the state institutions, the heads of the army and the police services and the intelligence services and the courts and all of that on the one side in the state, and on the other side, all the economic power that I referred to before. And should the Parliament come to be seen as disruptive to those institutions, then they can simply band together to get rid of or overthrow or replace the Parliament. And that's happened a number of times in pretty much most democratic or parliamentary democracies. And it's through the process of that over time that you've seen a situation where so-called socialist parties, who have seen their role as forming governments in order to transform the lives of the working class for the better, have become what they are now. In most countries that you go to in the world, there'll be something called the Labour Party or the Workers' Party or the Socialist Party or the Social Democratic Party, which was founded often through long, painful effort by the workers' movement with the goal of getting elected into Parliament, forming a government and changing things for the better. And those parties are overwhelmingly despised in pretty much every country where they exist or thereabouts for their many, many crimes and betrayals that they've perpetrated against the people who supported them and put them together. Indeed, even because of that, the fact that the state institutions, of which Parliament is only a tiny part, are instruments of the continued dominance of the capitalist class, means that even just the process of seeing elections as the primary way that you're going to change things has an effect of destroying the fight for reforms, even in the here and now. And there's a number of examples of that that we've actually heard about at this conference. It's happening now, even with the campaign, for example, to prevent the development of the Adani Carmichael coal mine in Queensland. There's a strong current of thought that in the various campaign groups associated with that, that because the only way that's going to be stopped is with the election of a purportedly sympathetic Labour government, then the key task, really, of the social movements now is to protect the Labour Party from any criticism that would make it more hard for them to win the election. So if anyone points out that, as the Labour Party's environment spokesman has boasted recently, Labour's environment policy is one that was originally thought up by Tony Abbott, if you point that out, then you're making it less likely the Labour government will get elected. If a Labour government's not elected, there's no way we're going to stop the Adani Carmichael coal mine, because it's only through Parliament that things like that can really be changed. Therefore, our job is basically to become passive advocates of people who are our enemies. So it's clearly it's not a neutral decision-making body. It's not a path to socialism. Not even, I would argue, a path to meaningful reforms. Brings us to the question of political parties, which are closely associated with the concept of Parliament. What's the point of a political party? For most people, the concept of a political party is intimately connected to Parliament. In fact, what a political party is a machine for the promotion of election of parliamentary candidates. That's it. That's what a political party generally conceived is supposed to be. For some, more left-wing, you can have the position that a political party should do multiple things. It should 100% definitely try to get candidates elected into Parliament to form government, change the law. And also, it should participate in campaigns and social movements, and it should try to build struggles in the, you know, in the streets, in the workplaces, and so on. That's the more left-wing position. What you find, though, is that's a pretty unstable combination because of that tension that I pointed to before. And most parties, in fact, all parties, that have tried to walk that line of both forming a government and entering into the process of dominating society and helping the oppressed struggle against the injustice of society, are forced to choose and tend to choose the one that they think is more powerful, which is participation in government. That's happened to the Labour Party, like I said before. I would argue it's happened to the Greens as well, and I think it'll happen to any political organisation that tries to walk both lines of forming government and struggling against the most powerful institutions in society. The position that Socialist Alternative has is that we need to aid in the construction of a different type of political party, broadly conceived, that is a revolutionary party, a revolutionary socialist party, that is based around the culmination and development of those kinds of struggles outside of Parliament and against the powerful institutions in society, that tries to politicise them, and that's based around promoting and putting into effect a non-parliamentary theory of social change, a theory of social change that's based on the exploited, the working class in particular, using their own collective powers to fight against the ruling class and to develop their own institutions to make decisions and don't rely on the ones that have been given to them, such as the Parliament. The alternative, which you've really heard about at previous sessions, there's a sort of a blanket term we use to describe it as a way to make decisions that can affect the biggest questions in society. We use the term workers' councils to talk about our alternative to Parliament, a revolutionary alternative to Parliament. A workers' council is a pretty general term. It's a thing that can develop in a lot of different ways with a lot of different kind of specifics, but the basic principle of it is it's a process of democracy that emerges within the working class, that takes in their economic life, and that functions all the time. There isn't just something that you elect representatives into in an isolated political sphere where they sit in a parliament and pass laws, but it's something that you participate in your workplace, collectively with other workers. Workers' councils are the institution that we would argue has to be created for the working class to wield power. Right now, most people are probably reasonably familiar with that argument by the last session of the Marxism Conference. Right now you don't have them. You just have parliaments, really, and elections. So what do you do about them? I've talked about the negative processes that can happen when you prioritise elections as the main goal of politics, or the definition of what politics is. So what do you do? The arguments that has had a lot of currency on the far left, the revolutionary left, is abstain from elections completely. Don't participate. It's enemy territory. Don't do it. Pretty understandable. And it seems, I think, like the immediate logical conclusion from the arguments that I've outlined. There's a lot of variations on it. You can say you should boycott this or that election, but I'm talking about the argument that you should never participate in elections or try to get elected into Parliament for any reason. That's often associated with the idea that you should reject anything that isn't a revolution. Basically, don't try to fight for reforms, don't try to participate in trade unions. I'm not going to consider those arguments. I just want to consider the thing about elections and Parliament. I think there's a lot of problems with this position. I think it's wrong. Partly it's because of the fact that it's a bad fact, but it is a fact, which is that for most people, parliaments and elections are the focus, the definition of what politics is. And that can be pretty hard for us to see the potentialities that exist in that, because politics in Australia and elections are usually so bad. Most people consider the definition of politics to be who's in elections, who's in the parliament, who's on a ballot, who's campaigning, because that's what politics is. Everything else that happens, you can work for a company that produces poison to sell to companies that do lethal injections in the United States for the government of Texas. It doesn't matter. That's not politics. That's just work. And you can have all kinds of problems in your, you know, you can't find aged care for your grandparents that isn't, you know, torturous. That's just your private life. That's not politics either. What happens in the elections is politics, and the biggest questions of all have to be addressed in that sphere. Even in periods of really high struggle, even during revolutions, who's on the ballot in an official election pretty much sets the boundaries for how you can interpret what's going on in the world and who thinks what. And if you're not in them, then that process sets the boundaries outside of what the revolutionaries want to argue. And you can't, there's not all these positive examples from recent history in Australia. There is a negative example, though, Fraser Anning, who through his presence in the parliament has given a powerful impetus to fascist politics in this country, has served as a kind of beacon. Every fascist in the country knows if you want to talk to other fascists and organise with them, try to get involved in Fraser Anning's political organisation, because he's used this platform in Parliament to quite openly argue for fascist politics. And you can imagine this is a sort of a horrendous way to conceive of it, but a socialist Fraser Anning would actually be able to make quite a substantial contribution to Australian politics now. If there was someone in the Parliament that was advocating for working class struggle, workers' rights and socialism, this could make an important difference. There's a position... Sure, if you don't want to abstain and you want to participate, there's the inside and outside argument that I referred to before, taken to its logical conclusion, the idea you should try to form governments, capture the state, and also engage in struggle, perhaps to defend your own government. It doesn't work, though, at the point, and I've talked about how it has the process of smothering struggle short of a revolution. In revolutionary periods, it has quite a catastrophic impact, where at the point where the working class are developing their struggle such that they are developing institutions that can challenge the rule of the capitalist class all through society, in the economic sphere, in the state, and to challenge Parliament's capacity to rule, then you are faced with a choice. Do you destroy the existing state, or do you maintain it? Do you replace it with the institutions the working class have developed, or do you get rid of those institutions in order to preserve the existing ones? If you have a political organisation, the purpose of which is in part to hold government, then you've made your choice before the revolution's even begun, because you're saying you've cultivated a worldview, a structure of your organisation, and a set of political practices that's based around the idea that push comes to shove, the way we're going to make change is through having government. Being in government is a necessary... They often say it's not sufficient, you need struggle as well, but if it's a necessary part of putting through change, then in a revolutionary circumstance, you have to choose the existing institutions over those of the working class. And that's led socialist governments time after time, where worker struggle has proceeded to a point where it really threatens the institutions of capitalism, to passively sit back or actively take part in the suppression of the working class and often the installation of extreme right-wing dictatorships. So there is a third socialist approach, which is to take part, even if the elections are partial, even if they're rigged, even if the franchise is restricted, participate in elections to argue for a form of politics that says parliamentarism, electoral politics, shouldn't be the focus. That is, you participate in the elections to argue against a parliamentarist worldview. And you've got to make some things clear that aren't often, well, that are often misunderstood about this, particularly by critics of it, such as anarchists, who think that this is the same as attempting to form government through a parliament. You can participate in elections with no intention and indeed the active renunciation of any desire to form a government, not because you want to pass legislation either and institute reforms that way. You can participate in elections and even try to win them. Just have a minority revolutionary, a socialist voice in the election, in the parliament. There's a few examples of this. People often refer to the Bolsheviks, indeed the Russian socialist movement more broadly, who participated in elections to the so-called parliament that existed in Russia prior to the revolution, even though everyone knew that parliament was nothing. That really was an irrelevant decoration for an absolutist state. And they still took part in the elections there because the elections were a chance to talk about politics in a repressive regime. And having the presence of socialist parliamentarians there, even with no power, was a way to organise the socialist movement in Russia. Okay, but that's a pretty different society from what we're in. Better example might be the Germans. In the German parliament, prior to the revolution, the German socialist movement. I'll come back to the problems that I talked about earlier. But, for example, when their publications were banned of the socialist movement in Germany, you could have parliamentarians who had the right to make speeches in parliament that could then be printed and turned into effectively socialist pamphlets. Because if they want to create the illusion that parliament is this free, democratic, equal place where everyone's got the right to participate, then to an extent they've got to let you say what you're going to say and they've got to let you distribute that. And so that's a way to, even in a very repressive society, to use the fact that parliament sows illusions to undermine those very illusions themselves. When the German state, or the Prussian more accurately state, went to war with France, two of the socialist members of parliament, this is in the late 19th century, August de Babel and Wilhelm Liebknecht, who I'll come back to, spoke against the war in the most principled terms in the parliament. Their political party then was banned as a result of that. When the war reached its conclusion and the foreign working class, the French working class, rose up in the Paris Commune and seized control of Paris for a period, Babel and Liebknecht in the parliament spoke in support of these French workers at a time when Germany was at war with France, in support of the French workers, their revolutionary seizure of power, and they used their position in a parliament to argue that the working class should seize power like in France and not bother about parliament, basically, in an incredibly courageous and principled stance in parliament. And for that, they were both jailed for treason, as a result of which, in the next elections, the socialist vote in Germany massively increased. And Babel and Liebknecht were both re-elected into the parliament from prison after that. Now, that's a significant, not in terms of saying, well, great, because if they get more votes, maybe they can form a majority and win an election. That's significant for saying, well, this is a test of the consciousness of the working class, and it's something that's developed the consciousness of the working class by participating in the parliament and making those speeches. they've won a whole section of the working class, the idea that in solidarity with the French workers against whom their government was currently at war, they should take part in the process of a revolutionary seizure of power. Very impressive revolutionary intervention, I would argue, in a parliament. A few decades later, there was a revolution in Germany, and an interesting example of an election. They had workers' councils and all the rest of it existed at that time. Working class were constructing their own institutions. But to fend that off, the ruling class effectively, shorten the story somewhat, called an election to a national assembly. It was a bourgeois election, capitalist election, the premise of which it was going to write a constitution. And it was said to be the culmination of this revolution. Don't worry about the workers' councils. We can shut them down once we get our national assembly to write a constitution. And these two things were counterposed against each other, the working class institutions or the national assembly. And there was a debate at that time, what was then the Communist Party of Germany. Do we participate in the elections to the National Assembly? We're communists. We know what we think should happen, that these workers' councils should deepen, spread throughout the country and take power. There's a set of national elections being organised with the express intent of undermining those councils and replacing them with capitalist rule through a new constitution. What do we do? There was a strong current of thought. In fact, they won the argument at the time that the Communist Party should abstain from those elections. Rosa Luxemburg, who's on my shirt, argued for participation. She said to those who opposed participation, in which way do you want to influence the elections if you declare from the start that we view the elections as being null and void? So that's sort of the premise. We have to show the masses that there's no better answer to the counter-revolutionary motion against the system of councils, that's the workers' councils, than to achieve a massive demonstration of voters who vote for precisely those people who are against the National Assembly and for the system of councils. That is the active method of redirecting the firearm that's being aimed at us by aiming it at our opponent's breast. So the Communist Party of Germany didn't, in the end, accept that argument, didn't participate in those elections, but dramatically limited their influence in the period immediately following the construction of the National Assembly. What the approaches have in common that I've outlined are the things I mentioned at earlier. They're not trying to form a government. They're in the elections basically in order to disrupt that process that parliamentary elections can have of consolidating the power of the ruling class. And specifically, they're taking part to argue that parliament is not the primary method or even a significant method through which to achieve social change, let alone socialism. They've got something else in common as well, which is a sadder thing. They're very good examples, but the negative is they're all from around 80 to 150 years ago. And there's a reason for that, which is that the development of Stalinism from the late 1920s means that pretty much from then on, we have very few good examples of communist practice to draw on. Basically, every communist party... There are examples. The Communist Party had members of parliament here and there in this country that did some good things and a lot of bad things as well, but it's difficult to come up with a clear good example because of the horrendous influence that Stalinism had on the workers' movement over that whole period. And then Stalinism collapsed in most, not all, of the world, and we're having to rebuild basically from square one. And that brings us up to now, where we're getting to the point in this country, it's happened earlier in other countries, where participation in elections is sort of on the edge of being potentially practical for revolutionaries. So what's happening now? Okay. Well, when you talk about socialists and parliament, most people would think of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, so on. These are not socialists really in the sense that we would use the term here. Not really. There's different ways people use the term. For the perspective that I've outlined, a socialist approach to elections, doesn't apply to those people. They're for redistribution of wealth, and that's good. I agree with them about that. But they're not socialists in the sense that that we discussed at this conference previously. And it's a good sign about where things are going, and they can play a positive role, that they are popular among a number of people, and they can act as, and have acted in some instances, as really effective advocates for reform. And the fact that they're popular now can be a stepping stone on the way, hopefully will be, to even more deep radicalisations in the future. And so we should support them, obviously, when they do good things, and we should criticise them when they do the wrong things. But this is not at all what we're talking about when we talk about what socialists should do in Parliament. These are, in particular, not only are they not arguing against a parliamentary approach to social change, quite the opposite. Every single one of these people is arguing stridently that parliaments, elections, the presidency of the United States are the key things that you've got to capture and take part in if you want to make any difference whatsoever. And although they can offer passive support for people who do other things, such as workers on strike and so on, they do absolutely nothing to undermine the idea that taking part in and merging with the government is the way forward for the left. So that's quite a separate... how to relate to those developments is quite a separate question from the question of what socialists, revolutionary socialists, should say about parliament. In terms of what Socialist Alternative is doing, we've always actually, contrary to myth, have always wanted to participate in elections and have judged until recently that it's not worth doing because it takes a lot of resources to make a serious run in elections. And the most important thing that we focus on is building up our forces, our understanding of Marxism, our participation in activist campaigns and trade union work and so on, and growing our group to the point where it can have more of an impact in broader social struggles. There's a lot of small socialist groups that have thought that by participating in elections they can gain a mass audience sort of without having to do the hard work of building their group, and that hasn't worked. That's not what... We've avoided that and focused on building our group in a pretty sensible way, I would argue. We've done that so successfully that in some circumstances, in Melbourne in particular, where we've grown to be the biggest socialist group in pretty much every city in the country now, I think, but we're substantially much, much bigger in Melbourne. In Melbourne, we reckon we're at the point where, in coalition with other allies and other socialists, well-known activists, people from other groups as well, we think we can put together electoral interventions that have a shot of actually making some impact on a mass scale, you might say a small mass scale. And we took part in the state election last year, and we're doing it again in the federal election in just a few weeks. Last year's campaign was a real success. We got 30,000 votes across Victoria, concentrated in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, including the working class suburbs in the outer north, which is the biggest socialist vote for independent socialist candidates outside the Labor Party. It's happened in some decades in this country. And we nearly won. We didn't win because of the preferences. We were close to winning, and if we had won, you can look at the example of Fraser Anning. You can imagine how much improved things would be when the strike broke out that was discussed on the opening night of this conference at Chemist Warehouse, when the fire that was discussed at the opening night of the conference happened in the northern suburbs, poisoning huge swathes of the northern suburbs. When those events took place, if we'd had revolutionary activists in the state parliament of Victoria who could use their prominence there to act as an advocate for the working class in those instances, it would have made a really big impact. And hopefully we will have a socialist in the Victorian Parliament soon. And if there are more significant developments, such as a war, then you can imagine the importance of having socialists in Parliament who can actually speak out in distinction to what's on offer now. This year's campaign, running in three places in the federal election. Two of them are broadly places where the contest is between the Labor Party and the Greens. That's an important type of seat to contest, I think. One of them, for example, are the Labour candidates, Jed Carney, one of the most effective and most utterly cynical, I would argue, former left-wing so-called trade union official, former head of the ACTU, now very effective and cynical PR person for the Labour Party, a master of, you know, sort of taking photo ops with refugee advocates and so on, doing absolutely nothing to change the policy of the Labour Party or promote any struggles outside of the Labour Party definitively. And to contest in elections where people like that are running and to say that the so-called Labour left isn't enough, and the Greens, who've just purged their entire left in an absolute bloodbath, are also not enough, and that there needs to be a whole different worldview represented in Australia that's based on rejecting the system of capitalism and supporting the struggles of the working class and the oppressed. I think that's quite an important thing to introduce now into Australian politics and could have a really serious impact down the line, if we can consolidate that socialist vote and create tens of thousands of people in Melbourne who know, yes, I vote for the socialists in the elections. I've heard their arguments time and again, and I know that's the worldview that I identify with, and what the socialists say I take seriously, and those are people that I identify as fighters on my behalf. That could have a real impact down the line. I think it's an important task to do. And as well, in the division that's called Corwell, that's further out north, that's where the factory fires tend to happen most, a very working class area and a safe Labour seat, where there's, we know from participating in the state election, intense anger at the Labour Party and the way it treats its working class support base. that cynicism and anger, if that's turned into a hope that you could actually have, that socialism offers something for the working class that could make a difference in the future, that could be one of the most important contributions on a mass scale, I think, that socialists could make. And it can lay the basis for much more serious socialist campaigns in the future. There are limits to it. One of the hardest limits, I think, that we encounter, and hopefully that will change, is that there's not all this mass struggle happening in Australia or even nearby. We don't have a Paris Commune equivalent to make reference to, let alone workers' councils. And that makes it a much harder task to explain that our worldview is based on, yes, a comprehensive rejection of a profit-driven system and the idea that the struggle of the oppressed can challenge the whole system. It's harder, and hopefully it will be in the future, but it's still an important element of it. But one of the arguments that we can make that gets a strong response, that I think is one of the most important arguments to make now, is that fighting for the rights of the working class and the organisation of the working class, the dignity of the working class, goes hand in hand with and is a key part of fighting against racism, fighting in defence of the environment, fighting against sexism. These are arguments that both Labour and the Greens try to separate into the bread and butter issues, so-called, of the working class to improve their living standards on the one hand, and on the other hand, the so-called social justice questions that are about treating people with compassion. Actually, the working class can lead and can take part in struggles against all forms of oppression. These issues can be tied together. The scapegoating of migrants is bad for the working class, and the working class will be in a much better position to the extent that they reject it. These are important arguments that I would argue at this point only socialists are able to make convincingly, and that socialists have a great opportunity to argue in the state elections, which is why I'll be campaigning strenuously from next week. So I'll do that knowing, though, that like this will be a political campaign. We're not going to win parliamentarians out of this campaign, but we can lay the basis for winning them in future campaigns, and we can make a political argument about socialism in this campaign that can pay dividends far into the future. Even knowing that, you've got to know, doing it, that you're intervening on enemy ground. It's important to intervene on enemy ground. You can't leave them a field of action that you're not going to interrupt. You've got to fight where they want you to fight, and you've also got to fight where they don't want you to fight, in the workplaces and on the streets. That remains, though, that field of direct, immediate social struggle, our most important work, and organising and promoting and building belief in that. We want to intervene. I think socialists should attempt to intervene and take part in Parliament only to the extent that they can build those kinds of struggles, build people's faith in their own capacities, and build their confidence that the system can be replaced with something fundamentally better.